After having gone through that, he realized what an enormous need there was for palliative care outreach, to give people information on palliative care, how to access it, and where and when to find it. And so began the Council on Palliative Care. Our mission is exactly as David envisioned it, to promote increased understanding and availability of palliative care within and beyond McGill University Healthcare Network. We pursue this object by networking with healthcare planners, educators, practitioners, and the community at large. Since David died in 2003, we have had either a lecture or a workshop in his name almost every year. In the years when there has been an international congress, we try to have it at the same time, and this year, not only is it at the same time, but it's in the same place, in order for congress registrants to be able to participate. Could I just ask you how many congress registrants there are? Oh, great. So it worked. Okay. This, however, is a bit different from our usual lecture format. We're presenting excerpts from a play by Nell Dunn called Home Death, which was originally produced in London, England. The subject is, after all, at the core of what we do. Yet even with us, death has become medicalized, and our immediate resource when somebody is dying is a hospital. This play explores in a wonderful and immediate and yet thoughtful way some of the alternatives. As I mentioned, it was written for a London audience, so some of the references may be a bit different to those of you who are accustomed to Canada. However, I know that as caregivers, you'll all get it. I hope that you will come away from this evening with a better understanding of some of the problems and the solutions of dying at home. And I'm now going to turn over the evening to Joanne Jones, a palliative care nurse and our moderator for the evening. She will introduce the evening, the actors, and the panel to you.
Thank you, Kathy. Could I ask, please, before we start, if anybody has any cell phones, if you could please turn them off for the duration? Thank you. This evening's performance and presentation is designed to include your participation in the form of your written bilingual questions and comments. So inside your program, everyone has a program, you will see three blank papers. So we would ask you to write your questions and comments on these papers. We have chosen three excerpts from Nell Dunn's play portrayed by four actors: Jennifer Finestone, Simon Driver, Lois Jones, and Carrie Foster. At the end of the three vignettes, there will be 10 to 15 minutes for your questions that would be related to that particular scene. So we ask that you please write clearly and quickly. Members of the council will go up and down the aisles and they will pick up your questions and collect them for discussion by our excellent panel. Dr. Golda Tradinsky, who is a palliative care physician, Sue Britton, who is a palliative care home care nurse, Zelda Freitas, who is a social worker, and Anita Mountjoy, who is a family caregiver and a nurse. There will be time until 9 o'clock. I know some of you saw 8:30. We had planned until 9 o'clock for the rest of the questions from the audience. We also encourage you to refer to our website if you've got any further questions, and this information on the screen, but it's also on the back of the program that you have. Nell Dunn, at the age of 75, is a distinguished writer of plays and novels. She chose to use her own story to write her last play, Home Death, in 2011. A series of interlinking voices on the subject of dying at home that came from real-life experience of interviewed people. She said, "I wrote Home Death because after the death of my partner at home, I realized I knew so little about how to comfort and take care of the dying. So I began to ask other people, and what I learned I put into the play. I started with my own story. I was heartbroken I had not helped Dan more." This is our first play with Nell and Dan.
I am Nell, and Dan was my lover. Dan caught a ferocious bronchitis. He had a chest x-ray, and a 6-centimeter tumor was found on his lung. He was operated on, recovered, and came home to his flat over the road from me, and with wonderful treatment from the NHS, was well for 5 years. And then it came back, and he had more treatment, got well, and then suddenly was extremely ill and taken into hospital and hated it. And the general consensus was that he's going to die at any moment, and he should go home. So, too weak to look after himself, he came to my house. My lover for 15 years, but separate houses. I'm a writer, I can only work in an empty house. And he was suddenly being carried up the stairs in a chair by 2 paramedics. And although that same morning a horrible hospital bed had been delivered and his chair was heading towards it, he pointed majestically towards my bed and said, "There!" And that's where for 18 months he slept, and that's where he died. Dan wanted to die at home. He was on 24-hour oxygen, nothing more could be done. However, the few days predicted on his discharge from hospital became 18 months of good life. The week before he died, he asked me to sit with him. He wanted to tell me something. Primrose, our dog, was on his lap, and I sat on the sofa across from his chair, and he told me, "I know I'm going to die soon, and I'm ready for it. I want to die well, but I don't quite know how to get from here to there." He went on speaking, but I was deaf. I said nothing to reassure him, nothing about the huge love I felt for him, nothing about the happiness he had brought me, nothing about what a wonderful lover he was. I sat frozen in silence while Dan and Primrose looked at me. I didn't believe he was going to die. I knew he was, but I didn't believe it. Eventually, he said, "Thank you for listening to me." I got up and silently left the room, dizzy with shock and terror. Later, I said, "Don't worry if you pee or poo on the floor. It's a wooden floor. I can easily wipe it up." I knew he worried when he got up in the night. "That is so reassuring, my love," he said. The next day was my birthday, and he sent me to the Conrad shop to buy myself a present. "You wanted an overnight bag, so go and choose one. Take my card." When I came back, he examined the bag with great care. "I think it's very well made," he said. He was in charge of his own medicines, but towards the end, he wanted me to do them for them. I made a list, and I took them over to the bed, and he made a little dent in the duvet, and I put them in, and he took them one by one, swallowing them down with water. These moments were precious. You wouldn't think so, but they were. He got a sore on his bottom. The district nurse put a plaster on it, but soon after she left, it fell off. "Can you put another one on for me?" he asked. "I'm not your wife," I said. "Oh, all right, I will." And I did. And it was fine. And later still, he said, "My love, you are so kind to me." I'm shocked at some of the things I said. "I can't wash your feet today, I haven't time." "No, you can't have a stair lift because it would spoil the carpet." Spoil the carpet. Spoil the carpet. I was so angry he was going to leave me. He was going to abandon me. He was going to die. And quite simply, I couldn't bear it. 3 days before he died, he was visited by the hospice nurse who knelt down beside the bed. Our double bed. Dan never slept in the horrible, scary, cold hospital bed that sat unused, cluttering up our bedroom for 1.5 years. Anyway, the nice hospice nurse knelt down, perhaps to be on the same level with his patient while they discussed his discomforts. He was a nice man, and he reassured Dan, "Your care will be every bit as good as if you were in hospice. You will have hospice at home." And he sent a fax to the GP for a morphine prescription. Later that day, the district nurse came by with a plastic box which contained a morphine driver, and it was left in the bedroom. This was Thursday. This is what happened. At 6:30 on Sunday morning, after getting up to go to the toilet, Dan called me to help him back into bed. Soon he became uncomfortable and was having difficulty with his breathing. His lungs were bubbling, and he felt he was drowning. He asked me to get help, and as instructed, I rang the district nurse's night number. A district nurse and a student nurse arrived at 6:54 a.m. She decided he needed morphine and went to set up the driver. She found there was no morphine in the box, and therefore no point in setting up the driver. She managed to get him to swallow one green and one purple MST tablet with a little water. She said her shift was finishing, and she would pass him on to the day staff, and they both left. Dan was now experiencing extreme discomfort, and he asked me to get help. I rang the hospice that had been visiting Dan for about 2 years and was told there was no one there who could speak to me, and to ring back after 8:30 a.m. At about 9 a.m., being still alone and Dan suffering, I rang the hospice again and spoke to the same person. I said I needed help urgently. I was transferred to an answering machine, and I hung up. I put a little Oromorph in Dan's mouth, but it ran out. I gave him lorazepam, but that came out too. At about 10 a.m., a daytime district nurse arrived and again searched the box for morphine. She left and came back with yet another district nurse. They crowded into the bedroom and discussed the situation with extreme anxiety. They rang an out-of-hours doctor to come and write a prescription for morphine. Dan asked me to get help for pain in his chest. At about 11 a.m., a doctor on call arrived and asked the nurses what strength of morphine they wanted. Well, they didn't know, and he became irritated and cross with them. He spent a long time looking at his book and arguing with them. Dan tried to ask the doctor for help, but by this time he couldn't speak clearly. But the doctor didn't even examine or look at Dan, not even casting a look in his direction, let alone a gentle, reassuring word. Dan tried to get out of bed, but I lifted his legs back in, and he lay down again. He was agitated and struggling to stay calm. I know him so well. He wanted a dignified death. After consulting a book for some time, the doctor wrote out a prescription. There was a lot of talk about which chemist might be open on a Sunday, and nobody knew. Doctor was annoyed about how to find morphine and suggested various places, and then he left. As he left, I said, "Thank you for coming." "Don't worry. I get very well paid for this," was his reply. The nurses left to look for more morphine. I was alone with Dan. I lay beside him and talked to him. His breathing was very rapid. He was opening his eyes and looking around. He echoed my words of love but could barely talk. It was good that he was in our double bed because I could be beside him and talk to him. His eyes would open and search for me. "I'm here." He seemed to go in and out of sleep. Primrose got on the bed and lay beside him. After about 2 hours, his breathing went quiet and he seemed to be sleeping peacefully. He opened his eyes for a moment and he looked at me in a blaze, full on. I kissed his hand and lay close to him. And then he shut his eyes and I think I dozed on and off, keeping him company. After about 20 minutes, he stopped breathing. I think he died at about 1:30 in the afternoon. At about 4 o'clock, the nurse returned with the morphine. She'd been searching for it for 5 hours. In all, 5 national health staff attended Dan's death. 2 night district nurses, 2 day district nurses, and 1 out-of-hours doctor. Yet not one was trained to help a dying man, and none of them offered human support. After Dan died, all his children came. My sister came. My children came, and we lay on the bed beside him and cried and talked till late in the night. And Primrose lay alongside him and never moved till the undertakers came to take him away. He died at home, where he wanted to be. "This has been the happiest year of my life," he had said a few days ago. We had gotten so close. "What will I do without you?" I asked. I don't know, he said. What will I do without you? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
While the papers are being questioned or collected, if you have any questions or comments that you'd like for our panel, we will look at a question for Dr. Trudunsky and give you time to write them out and hand them to the members of the council that will come up. Dr. Trudunsky, the question that we have here for you is, how can a symptom crisis, perhaps like the morphine, be best addressed at home?
So the first thing that we need is, first of all, people who are experienced, nurses and doctors who are experienced in taking care of patients at end of life so that they can predict the kinds of crises that can happen in the home. And even on the first visit, ideally prescriptions should be made so that these crises can be taken care of in the home. Things like medications that can help relax an anxious patient, such as medications like Ativan, which can be given under the tongue if the patient can't swallow. Medications in the morphine family that can help with pain, that can help with shortness of breath. These medications can be prescribed either in suppository form, in liquid form. Of course, they can be pills. And if we feel that the patient is actually quite close to the end of his life or her life, we can prescribe those medications also subcutaneous. So there's a variety of different medications that can be prescribed relatively early on so that they can be already in the home in case a situation like the one described here does arise. It does take people, whether they be nurses or doctors, people who are experienced, to be able to not only know which medications need to be used, but also teach the family. The family needs to be prepared to administer these medications, and they need to recognize when it should be administered. So there's a lot of teaching that needs to be done to the patient, but mostly to the caregivers in the home about recognizing when a crisis is occurring and what medications need to be prescribed. What's also really important is to make sure they have access to healthcare providers who can help direct them when they have questions. Things like there's the CLSC nurses who know the patient and can either come and do a quick visit in the home or can help administer the medications. There's also overnight and on weekends, there's an on-call service of palliative care specialist nurses who are in touch with specialist doctors who can also either prescribe new medications, bring in medications to the home if they weren't already there, or just help guide the family of how to help that patient in a crisis situation.
Thank you very much. We'll now take some of the questions from the audience. Joan Foster.
I'm going to start first with a wonderful statement. This is not a question. He was lucky that he had such a peaceful death despite no medical support. But a question that I do have is, my mother died and I never said I love you. How can we ever make up for that? I was young, only 20 years old. She was not in the same city as I was.
Well, Anita, would you like to take that question?
Yes, I think that's a very important question. And I think that this is what multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary teams help us do for patients and families to coach them. And unfortunately, in some situations, these people are not available. Sometimes even a support group, one of her own friends, could have coached her in that regard. But I know from my own experience how important it was to say those very same things to my husband.
Is there anyone else on the panel that would like to comment?
I believe that words are important, but also actions. And I think in, you know, the phone calls that that you make, in the caring that you transmit, even over long distances, you don't necessarily need to say I love you. Sometimes it's just the show of caring and the show of love that can be enough to actually transmit that message as well.
Okay, thank you. Our next question.
Do we have more informed persons re-helping the dying person in the home here?
We're trying very hard to teach the future physicians about the importance of palliative care and to expose them to palliative medicine as well, so that every one of the future physicians at least has the realization of how important it is to be able to take care of patients at end of life, not just when they're in a curative mode, but also when they are no longer curative, so that either they have the expertise themselves or they know how to refer, and they won't be afraid to refer to people who know how to practice palliative medicine. And I see that this kind of interest is also happening in the nursing environment as well, nursing education. There's more and more palliative care that's being taught, both at SAGEP level and also university level nursing. So there is a lot more that's happening. We're quite lucky here in Montreal to actually have quite a number of palliative care physicians who are providing home care or providing over like weekend and overnight on-call expertise to our nurses who are frontline in the community. However, I wish there was more teaching being done to those nurses because they really are frontline. And unfortunately, we are seeing some of our expert nurses who have been trained by some of our colleagues retire or being close to retirement. And we don't necessarily see as much training happening now as what used to happen for those nurses who are already out in the community.
I also work in home care here in Montreal, and I can say that in the last 15 years I've seen a growth of knowledge in the community about how to provide good palliative care at home, matching the expertise of people that work in home care with those that work in palliative care and end-of-life care. The approach tends to be a very multidisciplinary approach. So we have the physicians, the nurses, social workers, OTs, PTs, with some ongoing training, with some support for each other. I feel that the team is growing and there's more knowledge out there than there was 20 years ago.
Thank you, Zelda. Joan has one more question.
Knowing that this is an international congress, someone has asked the question, is it common to have morphine problems that were displayed in this film? Perhaps, Sue, you could address this.
I think it's a case of planning ahead, like Golda said, having the prescriptions ready, having the medications ordered in advance, so on weekends and at night and different times that crises do develop, those things are taken care of. But it's all in the planning. So I think that that's the important issue, is to have things in advance.
Thank you, Sue.
From my own
experience. Now go on.
I'm sorry, Anita. Go ahead.
From my own experience, this planning was done, and drugs were in the home, and they were prepared for administration in advance.
Thank you.
And I will just add, just very quickly, that we work in partnership with the pharmacy that's serving the patient. So we can ask the pharmacy a bit in advance to see if they do have injectable morphine. And if they don't, if they could actually get some from another pharmacy or go in and find a pharmacy that does provide these kinds of medications. And very often in home palliative care, we deal with one or two pharmacies that we know are reliable and have these medications in stock at all times.
Thank you. Okay, we'll now go on to scene two, Trevor and Leslie.
I'm Trevor. This is Leslie, my sister. We lived in suburbia when I was in my teens. I was in a play at the Royal Court, and then I wanted a different life. I was a rebel. My mom was upset about my leaving home, and my sister, Leslie, well, she felt that she had to stay home, at least until she got married.
My mother was very artistic.
Both our parents came from poor backgrounds. They both left school at 14. When I was born, we were sleeping on friends' floors. They finally got a council house, but they were poor. Tea was a piece of bread with sugar on it. It was years before I had a steak. Our father did brilliantly and became a successful businessman and a manager of a company.
Mom had been suffering from chronic diarrhea and nausea for about 6 weeks, and she thought it was a tummy bug and said that she'd wait just to see if she could sort it out herself. And she had a couple trips to the doctor, but I had to force her to go because she wasn't really into doctors and medicine. And the third time she went, the doctor decided she should go to the hospital for tests. And the doctor asked her, "Does your family have a history of bowel cancer?" And she was offended by that remark.
It was the summer. I'd spent a bit of time with her because I was in Oxford teaching, near where she lived. She said she'd been feeling well, hadn't been feeling well, because she had an upset stomach. She was very cross because the doctor had asked,
was there a history of bowel cancer in the family?
She felt very angry that the doctor had said that, completely out of the blue. And it was very distressing. And why should he say that? And of course, there wasn't. What a stupid thing to say.
Well, she collapsed in the supermarket. And she rang me at work at about 5 o'clock, and she said, "An ambulance is coming, and I'm being admitted to the hospital now." And I thought, "What? Oh, my God." And so I called my brother Trevor, and then I just rushed straight to Mom's side.
Leslie phoned me up and said Mom had been admitted to the hospital, And Leslie was unhappy about this because she's a legal secretary and she has a lot of dealings with this hospital in particular. And there was MRSA there and a lot of patients were suing for poor care. And that my mom had gone into a ward and Leslie said it was filthy and there were too many beds, yeah, and only a few nurses. And she couldn't get to the toilet because she was on a drip and she could see blood splattered on the walls and on the stand next to the drip. And so Leslie wanted to move her into a private ward at the top of the hospital. And was this okay? And when I arrived, I was walking along the corridor, and there was blood splattered across the floor, and it was disgusting. And then suddenly there was carpeting, wood panels.
I think that she knew that it was bad news, because she started talking about our dad, who had died 4 years ago. On the Thursday, she had another scan and a liver biopsy, and she went into this room, and I had to wait outside. And Mom told me that when this process was finished, the nurse said, "Is your daughter here?" And Mom had a laugh and said, "Well, yes, she'll be waiting outside because she hasn't left my side since Monday." I mean, I wasn't going to go anywhere, but I was worried about my job. And I had made up my mind, stuff the job, I need to see this through to the end. I mean, they were brilliant at work, and they gave me 3 weeks compassionate leave on full pay. And I told them what was happening, and my boss said, "Go, you know, you do whatever you need to do, and just let us know." I remember her lying in bed and looking out of the window and seeing a tree and saying, "Look at the color." I mean, she was very aware of beauty till the end. But she wasn't worried about dying. The only time that I saw her cry was when we were in the hospital and she was in the middle of some tests and we were waiting to have another scan and she was sitting in the wheelchair and of course I'm sitting beside her and this woman went by on a trolley shouting and delirious and Mom looked at her and she said, "Will that ever be me? Please, please don't let that ever be me." And then she broke down and cried and I looked at her and I said, Mom, that won't be you ever. I won't let that be you.
And my mom was in this small room with her own bathroom. But she was much happier because she could get to the loo and Leslie was there. It was nice, but it was $500 a night. And that wasn't including medical care. And Leslie was angry because the doctor said he was off to a conference in London for 2 days and he wouldn't be able to examine Mom till he got back or talk to her.
Yeah, but that's $1,000 a night just because this guy's what? Yeah, what, going to some conference?
And nobody came, right? So Leslie and I went down to the canteen to have lunch. There is something disgusting about hospital canteens. Institutional, unwelcoming, horrible. And then we went back up, and a young doctor was in there talking to her, and he was saying that there was an abnormality in the tests. But he didn't explain it. And in the end, she said, "Have I got cancer?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "How long have I got?" And he said, "Well, these things can be quick." So I took him outside and tried to make it easy for him to tell him to say it again. And he said, "These things can be quick, blah, 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 blah." But he wouldn't look at me. And he looked at the floor, and he said, "About 6 months."
Trevor came down for the appointment with the consultant on Friday, and the consultant told her, "You've got cancer." And she said, "How long have I got?" Just like that. And the doctor said that she could have treatment, but he couldn't be sure it would buy her more time. And she said, "Well, yeah, I've just got to get on with it." But Trevor and I were finding it very hard not to cry. I mean, we didn't want to cry in front of her. She wouldn't have liked that. But she wanted to be on her own for a bit, and so I thought that was right for her. And so we left, and we're just standing outside the door, and we're hugging and crying, and then we go back in. And she says, "I don't want treatment, so don't even start." And I want to go home and be in my own bed, in my own room. So when things first started and Mom was admitted to the hospital, Trevor was in London and I was living down the road. It was important that I was the organizer, but Trevor was happy about that.
I said, "Are you frightened?" And she said, "No, our dad took it on the chin and so will I." It was a working class approach. She'd lived through the war.
I always knew she wanted to die at home because she had made a living will a few years ago. And it was very important to her that she had no treatment. I mean, she'd seen a lot of friends who'd gone down that road, and she felt that, well, if her time had come, so be it. But because she had moved from NHS to private, although it was in the same hospital, she couldn't get an ambulance to take her home, and so I took her. So I whiz home, and I change her sheets, I hoover her room, and I make it nice and comfortable, and I put on a lamp, and I get a hot water bottle, and it did look really nice. And then I go and I fetch her. Well, she's really weak, and she can't get up the stairs. And they were really steep stairs in her little house. I couldn't lift her or hold her even, because you couldn't fit two people in the steep stairs. It was just too narrow. So she went up the stairs on her hands and knees, and then I went up after her. But when she walked into the bedroom, she said, "Oh, that looks nice, and I'm home at last." So I helped her off with her clothes and put her into bed, and she just lay there and nodded off. And she looked really happy.
After my dad died, she was lonely. She wasn't really complete without him. It was an old-fashioned kind of marriage that lasts forever. When Mum knew she was going to die, she wanted to get on with it. So she mostly stopped eating and drinking, probably hastening her death. She was someone who just got on with things. She had to die, so let's get on with it. By now she had morphine driver, and I said to the nurse, you know what our mother wants, and you know what we want. She was kind of a midwife to help the dying.
She wasn't in pain. They'd given her an anti-nausea drug, and so she wasn't running back and forth to the loo all the time. And she said to me, "I'd sooner be in pain than have nausea." But I could tell that she wanted to be alone. And I had this letter to give to her GP, and so I settled her in and made sure she was comfortable. And then I left at about 5 or 6 o'clock, and I remember going into surgery, and it must have been the end of the day because it was deserted, and I remember this almighty feeling of loneliness that I had brought this woman home who was dying, and I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. She doesn't want help. She doesn't want any medication, and I'm scared. Trevor would have been there if I'd asked him to be. I remember I said to the receptionist, I have to hand this in to you, but I don't know what to do, and I'm lonely and I'm panicking, and my mother is dying at home, and I start just crying. And the receptionist says to me, "No, there's help." And she told me about district nurses and community nurses, and she said, "If you're worried about the night, there's the Mary Curry nurses who will come and sit with your mom all through the night and help her." Well, thank goodness there's help. Well, and from there, I just organized everything.
Watching my mother die was somehow connected to my children being born. It was beyond superficiality. It was real. I was in touch with something that goes back for thousands of years. It was very comforting.
For the next few days, Mom was eating a little bit and sitting up in her bed, and she said, "You know, it's not that bad having cancer, because lots of people have it, and they go on for ages. I can just putter around Chalbury and stay at home, and, you know, I'll be all right." Well, that went on for 2 or 3 days, but then on the Tuesday, she didn't want to get up, and she didn't want to eat, and so it was then that I decided that she needed help. So I got hold of the doctor, and I said, "Could you get a district nurse to come over?" And they were absolutely brilliant. In those 5 or 6 days leading up to her death, they became my best friends. And they were amazing, treating her as if she was the only patient that they ever had. We had one woman in to wash her, another to check the bedding and help her on and off the commode, and then there was another woman who would come later in the afternoon just to help wash her face and brush her teeth. And then the doctor and the district nurse worked together over her medicine. I mean, we went from nothing to everything, and people were were so good. I was overwhelmed. She was lying in bed, and she looked lovely.
I remember.
And Trevor and I were on each
side
of the
bed,
holding her hands, sitting on the floor.
And my mother.
And she looked at us just from one to the other. And she said,
my special ones.
I'll never forget that. She wanted me to wash her body. She was very keen on being clean. She didn't want to smell or for her breath to smell. And she said, please wash me. You don't think me silly, do you? And I said, no, Mom. And I washed her all over. It was very important for her to be clean. It wasn't like she was a vain person. I don't want you to think that. But she just wanted her dignity every day. A clean nighty. But I needed someone at night. Maybe I was a little bit frightened to be with her by myself. I thought, if I can get a good night's sleep, I could cope better. And so we got the Marie Curie nursing team to come in. And these are the nurses who give up their time to sit with terminally ill patients. These wonderful angels who just sit there all night just to make sure that Mom had company. She was pretty happy about that, but at this point she was in and out and she didn't really know what was going on. But Trevor was now on the scene, so he came and he sat with her. And I might cry if I tell you this. The thing that I couldn't really get was watching her die. I mean, this was huge for me, and I was terrified of the process. And I had this weird feeling like it was all about me, and then I felt guilty about that. It's Mom who's dying. Trevor asked her if she was frightened, and she said, no, I'm not frightened. I've never been frightened of anything. And I said, Mom, I'm going to miss you. What am I going to do without you? And she said, I want to be with your dad. I was frightened, but I wanted to be there. So she was on this morphine driver at this stage, and she had started to hold herself and feel really uncomfortable in her bottom area. And at this stage, she wasn't talking or eating. I would just give her these cubes to suck on, these sponges. And the nurse had given her a catheter. I walked into the bedroom, but something didn't smell right. Trevor was downstairs, and so when I lifted up the sheet, she was wearing these pajama tops, but no bottoms. And so when I lifted up the sheet, I could see that she was bleeding from her bottom. She was semi-conscious, and she put her hand round, and she felt the blood, and she was aware that she was bleeding. I rang the nurse, but she couldn't come back, and she told me what to do. She said, just roll her over, move the pad, put another one there, and then roll her back. But I couldn't do it. So Trevor and my daughter Laura had to come and help. And she was naked from the waist down. And I remember thinking that it was wrong, that Trevor shouldn't see her in this way, that Laura shouldn't see her grandmother naked, and she wouldn't have liked that.
Mom had blood on her hands. There was blood coming out of her. She had touched her bottom. And Leslie and I cleaned her up. She was like a child. Yeah. Like a young girl. And her face changed. She was very brave. I held her. I held her while Leslie cleaned her.
We did it as fast as we could. And once the morphine had kicked in, she didn't seem to be in any pain.
The night she died, I was sitting downstairs watching TV. And the TV, it suddenly stopped. It was broken. And I went upstairs and I said, oh, I love that TV. And now it's dead. Mom laughed. She had such a huge sense of humor. She was weak. She couldn't speak. But she laughed. Soon she seemed to be asleep, and Leslie said, why don't you go down to the pub? So I did.
I walked into the bedroom, and she was making this difficult breathing noise, and I was crying. And I said, I said, "Mom, you have to go. It's time." And then I shouted at the top of my voice, and I said, "You have to go. It's time to go." I think she heard me, and then I started counting her breaths. 1, 2, 3, and then she'd do this other huge breath. And I was kneeling beside the bed and holding her hands, and then I shouted one last time, "Mom, Mom, you have to go." And she took a great big breath, and she opened her eyes, and then there was nothing. And I just sobbed. And then I was euphoric. It was such a privilege, you know, such an honor to be there. I remember I put this red rose in her hand, and it really was the most wonderful experience of my life. And it was right that it was just the two of us there, that Trevor wasn't there. It was just us. I had been there from the very beginning, from the first day that she was admitted to the hospital. I had been by her side to the end. I'll never forget those district nurses. They were my closest and dearest friends, and I'll never see them again.
I just ordered a drink, and then my phone went, and it was Leslie telling me that my mom had died.
For Mom to die the way that she did was, I think, the best that she could have ever have hoped for. Quietly, not in too much pain, at home, and with me, her daughter, and her son nearby.
I notice that some of you at the back don't have papers, so if you do have a question, please put your hand up and one of the members of the council could bring you some more paper. We do have a lot here. So we will gather questions again related to this scene. And while we're waiting, I have a question for Sue Britton, our palliative care home care nurse. Sue, is going home always wanted, and is it always the best plan?
In this case, if we look at Trevor and Leslie, it was the right thing because she wanted to go and she had both children that were in agreement to help that happen. Is it always that case? Not always. I think what made the, Trevor and Leslie's situation go well is that they got, actually Leslie was able to ask for help. She knew where she needed information, so she went to the right source and asked for help, and they got the community nursing and doctors in to help that process. And the mother was very open about the whole issue around death, and that makes it much easier where there's no conspiracy. Everybody was honest and open about what was happening. The only thing that I felt a little bit sad about was that Trevor was sent off to the pub, where he could have benefited from being with his mom as well. But that's my judgment. I'm just, I would have encouraged, if I had been present, I would have encouraged that for him to stay close by. They got their sleep, which was important, because that's often the shift that causes problems. If people don't get enough sleep at night, they get irritable and they can't cope during the day. So that was good. Now, recently, I've had two patients die at home, but both of the wives did not want that to happen. They had 24-hour care. They had lots of support from their friends and family. But, you know, a lot does depend on the dynamics of people. Both those wives were insecure. They didn't want the memory of the death in their home. So that was one of the problems. Another problem was that one wife felt so responsible. Any changes physically in her husband, she felt had to be managed, not with just medication, but more in an acute way rather than a palliative way. So for I've really witnessed a lot of good home deaths, but it really does require a pivotal person in that milieu who can deal with problems, can call for help, knows how to, once they've given, been given the information, they know how to administer the help. So it really depends on the quality of the relationship. It's labor intensive, but it's also emotionally intensive. So it really depends on the people and how well they can cope. So one thing that I would suggest is that people have a contingency plan so that if they can't stay at home, they have another option, either to a hospice, to a hospital, or to a nursing home, but that the family don't feel trapped by having to continue something that's most difficult for them.
Thank you, Sue. Well, now to go to questions from the audience.
The first question is, what would be best for the dying? To hold our sadness or to freely show it? To be brave and not cry or to be honest and cry?
I think it's best to be honest. And people often will say, you know, I don't want him or her to see me crying. But it's a measure of love when one cries. It's not that you're losing control. It's just you're showing that you care. But there are people that are stoic, and to cry is really against their nature. So I don't think we want to force that kind of emotion. But certainly we can encourage it if it's something that's they just need to be helped to do so.
I agree with you, Susan, and in my situation, I felt that openness and sharing was the way to go.
I would just add that we've always said that, I've heard it being said that we die as we live, so we can't have people change the way that they communicate with others. We can open up that dialogue to see if they want to change their patterns, but it's not necessarily something that they may want to do, and we have to leave it to that person to decide what's best for them.
The next question is, dignity issues for the dying are huge issues for the family caregivers. How do we help the family accept the unacceptable? Giving permission to let go is difficult, but necessary. How do we facilitate this communication?
Well, I think that's something that I remember working on the ward in the hospital. And patients would wake up, and they were sorry that they'd woken up, actually. They said, I'm still alive. But it was because they wanted to die, but something was stopping them from that happening. And often how we would explain that is that the family weren't ready to let go. So sometimes they were told that they could actually teach their family about letting go because they were there and wanted to let go. So it's just a matter of communication, of feeling comfortable saying that they wanted to go. But I did that with my mom when she was dying. I was able to say that. She was very open about meeting her family on the other side. So I would just say to her, it's time to go, Mom. And I would name all the people that were waiting for her. And for me, it was comforting that I could say that. But and that was something that she believed in, so I wasn't enforcing something that she hadn't already discussed. But it's an important issue, actually.
I would just like to add that we can definitely be very helpful to family members that are in those situations. We saw very clearly in the presentation, in the skit, the two very different ways that Trevor and Leslie approached their mother's death. I think it's a classic example of a family that have different patterns of communication, different patterns of approaching death. And I think that we have to give our families the benefit of exploring what their patterns are, and it's very important for us to understand what they are, so then that we can work with those families in their presence and not in ours. So we may feel as professionals that letting go is the right thing to do, but that might not be what's right for that family, and I think we really owe it to the families to know what's best for them.
With respect to the whole question about dignity, it can be very difficult for patients to have other people taking care of them physically, their hygiene, etc., and maybe even more so with their own family members, depending on the relationships they've had with them. So it can be quite difficult, not just for the patient, but also for the family members themselves. And it may not be right for some family members to do this kind of basic care of washing somebody. It's not for everybody. But I think one of the ways we can approach that is that basically whether it's us healthcare providers or the family members, it's done out of caring for them, done out of love, that it's not a burden, and that it's just the kinds of things that should be done for each other, as they have provided for others themselves, maybe their own family members or their children. Now it's their turn to be taken care of. But it can be very hard on the patient's sense of dignity.
I think that dignity was exemplified in the vignette that we saw with the caring of the two adult children.
There are many questions, wonderful questions that have been given to us. We have time for one more question now, and hopefully at the end we can address some of the others. My question that I have now is, what about the patient who is in denial or just doesn't want to know? Would home care be out of the question?
Well, I've had that experience too, where I had to be actually one of the actors. I could have done some of the scenes that we saw. I went to visit a patient once, and the family met me downstairs before I went up to the upper duplex where the patient was living, and the daughter said, "Now you're not to ever talk about what's happening to him, and we want him to not know what's going on." So then she ran upstairs, and then I rang the doorbell and went upstairs, and she greeted me as if we'd never seen each other before. So I thought, you know, I went along with it for a while, but I thought, you know, this isn't very good, because if he asks me questions, I have to answer them according to the question. I can't play a game with him. But they had me doing all sorts of things, like, if he asks if I paid you, I paid you, you know, kind of thing. So I tried to stop that from happening, because it would just lead to, I didn't venture to tell him anything that I thought he should know, but I also wasn't going to play a part in that conspiracy. So that family actually learned that the conspiracy didn't help them in the long run, because they got themselves into a difficult position where they were always covering up. And so they couldn't really be honest with each other or with the patient. So the conspiracy is really difficult when people don't want to talk about it. I just think, I've heard doctors being asked that question, and they say, well, if a patient asks me a question, I have to be honest with them. I will not offer. I respect what you're saying, but I also have to respect the patient's question to me.
Palliative care needs to be available for all patients, those in denial and those who are realistic about their situation. So even when they don't want to talk about end of life, they don't want to talk about their disease, I think they can still be getting palliative care, whether it be in the home, in a hospice, or in a palliative care unit. It's just trying to also, well, first of all, avoiding the conspiracy of silence when the patient wants to know and they are asking, yes, absolutely, they should know. But sometimes the families actually know the patient so well. And the few times where I've been told, don't tell the patient, well, the patient actually didn't want to know. So the families were trying to respect the patient's ability to cope and the patient's desire to know what was going on. And I went along with what the patient was ready to talk about, but I was still able to provide palliative medicine, and we were able to provide a team effort to palliate this patient. So it's feasible.
I'd just like to add one comment, and that is that I view denial as a coping mechanism. And I think it's very important that we respect the patient's coping mechanisms. It also is an isolating way of approaching things, where in your denial, you're not talking to anybody about your fears and your suffering. And I also talk to families about concept of denial and isolating people from being able to reach out to others for support. And sometimes families are able to see that, and then they're able to move ahead and talk to their loved ones about their dying.
Thank you, Zelda. We'll now go on to scene 3.
Hello, I'm Diana, and this is George. I was down at our cottage near Newbury, and George was sitting and was going for an ordinary check of his lungs and a scan because he'd had pneumonia. Candy, my daughter, went with him, and they rang me up from the pub, and Candy said, well, it's cancer. And I was completely stunned. It was totally unexpected. I mean, if I'd expected it, I'd have gone with him to the appointment. And then George came on the phone and he said,
it's very small. I'll be fine. I don't want any treatment, and that's that.
I can't believe. I thought it was me who was going to get cancer. And for a while, the cancer disappeared. And then it came back, and it was very slow. In the spring of that year, for the first time, he didn't recognize me in the street. So, new cancer and the beginning of dementia. It happened at about the same time.
Stars shining bright above.
So that was the spring, and then in December, I called in at Ronnie Scott's, where he was singing over Christmas. He isn't expecting me, and he didn't recognize me. He's sitting with Shirley, his secretary, and she said, George, your lady wants to talk to you. And he looks up and sees me, and he takes my hand, and he kisses my hand, absolutely not recognizing me. And Shirley says, George, it's Diana, your wife, look. I was laughing, but then I began to put two and two together and realize that he had dementia. And then it was that I rang the Admiral nurses. George's GP had given me their number, and I got Madeline, and I told her what was happening, and she said, oh, that's much more likely to be vascular dementia. With Alzheimer's dementia, it's a progression, a rather steady progression. With vascular dementia, you can be fine one day and bad the next. We were going every 3 or 4 months for scans, and each time the tumor had grown a little bit, 3.5 centimeters, 4 centimeters. I'm quite got down by everything because he's incredibly forgetful. He loses his bank cards, and then he began to get aggressive, very aggressive to me, and very aggressive to people on the street. He got a terrible thing about fat black women. What about Bessie Smith? She was a fat black woman, and you adore her. So what is all this? I was very miserable. And then, of course, there's the lung cancer, so dementia and cancer. How long am I going to have to put up with this? Wouldn't it be better if he died? He had a girlfriend to lunch, and Shirley was there, and he said,
Shirley, I want you to do the washing up.
George, Shirley is your secretary, and I'll do the washing up.
I want Shirley to do the washing up.
George, Shirley is your secretary. You're a jazz singer, and I don't ask you to mend the lights.
I'm not just a jazz singer. I am a very important man.
That's not like George saying that. I'm a very, very important man. It was just so unlike him.
I'm not staying in these hotels either with the band. I want to stay in a grand five-star hotel.
He's still going out and about a bit on his own, and not nearly always in a taxi. He went on the tube to a party at the Whitechapel Gallery, so all he had to do was to get on the tube at the end of the road, which I took him to in the car, and he had to get out at Aldgate. He got there okay, but he got hopelessly lost coming back. And so I realized I must never let him take the tube on his own again. And then in January, it all got much worse, and I began to be very worried about him going away to sing because there was no way he could stay in a strange hotel. And the band was in complete denial about his dementia because once he was on stage, he would remember his words.
Night whispers, I love you.
The band wanted him to go on singing, and he wanted to go on singing, and I wanted him to go on singing. He was a performer. There were many hospital visits. He had quite a lot of different things wrong with him, as well as lung cancer. He had psoriasis. He had stomach ulcers. He had a heart condition. And feet. Oh. This woman was doing his feet, and as she was doing his feet, he was just incredible about me. Dreadful.
She's this. She's that. She doesn't respect me.
George, I'm in the room. I was in the room. I was going in and out of the room. And
she never says she loves
me.
She never says she loves me.
What do you think I'm doing all day except taking care of you? I am making it possible for you to sing. I drag you up to do a gig. I stay in dog-friendly hotels so that I can go with you. I spend ages in the supermarket looking for food that would tempt you because you are very difficult to feed. No appetite. And one week you want only smoked salmon, and then...
Why do you always get me smoked salmon? Always smoked salmon.
And then,
all you ever get me.
Yes, I know. And then he would want a one-egg omelet, which I used to find very hard to make. A one-egg boiled egg, this I can do. But a one-egg omelet is difficult. But I rather enjoyed some of it. I like taking care of people because you've got care and control if you're doing the caring. So I like choosing him biscuits that he might like, and he had a terrifically sweet tooth.
I want you to make me that nice pudding. Yeah, the one with jam in the middle. The one you used to make when I was a little boy.
Oh, George, I don't think that was me. Well, I do know how to make rice puddings with a dollop of jam on it, and that's fine. Then I used to buy him these really disgusting sweets, Black Forest Bateau. Oh, and he ate them. And I think I used to get through the nights of worrying, by thinking, how will I arrange the house when things get worse? We took it for granted that he would stay at home. So, and I was getting a lot of support from admirable nurses, and I was discussing it with them. At that moment, George's bedroom was on the second floor and his sitting room on the first floor, and my room and the kitchen were on the ground floor. So I would think to myself, okay, I could move him down to the first floor, but there's no toilet on that level, so what would I do? I could put in a lift. There's a little kitchen. I could get rid of that and put in a little toilet and a shower in there next to the sitting room. He could sleep there. I would spend all night thinking about the way I could organize the house for when he really got ill, because at that time I had no idea if it would be weeks, months, or even years. Goodness knows how long it was going to be or what state he would be in. Would it, on the other hand, be better to move him down to the ground floor? Oh, but then there was the smoking problem. By this time, George was smoking heavily again, and I really didn't try to stop him. But I'm asthmatic, and as the kitchen was downstairs, I thought, well, I can't have him downstairs and me in a bad temper because of his smoke. So then I thought, well, maybe we'll move him to the commode level. The commode situation. There'll be a bed sitting room and there'll be a commode, so that would solve that. I never really made final decisions. I just would think, well, if this happens, then it's plan A, and if that happens, well, it'll be plan B. That's how I relieve my anxiety. I sort out the problem before it happens. And that's in some way, that's a sign of being a pessimist, because I'm obviously thinking the worst. What I never thought about was that he'd be in hospital, that I'd have to visit. That absolutely never occurred to me. And then one day we saw his oncologist, and I said, "What's the prognosis?" This would have been in November. I didn't mean, when is he going to die? I meant, what happens now? But apparently it means, when am I going to die? And so the doctor said, well, George, you'll see this Christmas, but you won't see the next one. But George doesn't hear properly.
What'd he say?
You'll see this Christmas, perhaps, but not next.
Well, I don't like Christmas anyway.
Well, I think I felt better for knowing that I told George that I hadn't known what prognosis meant.
Well, that's very ignorant of you.
We were beginning to be able to make a bit of a joke of things, in a way, and things were definitely getting a bit easier. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe because I saw there was an end in sight, and maybe because he was getting so much more frail, losing his appetite, staying in bed most of the time, waking up only to have a cigarette. The doctor said, I'll put you in touch with the Macmillan nurses. And I remember that cold hand on my heart. I thought, once you have the Macmillan nurses, the end is in sight.
Stars shining bright above you. Night breezes seem to whisper, I love you.
There was a gig in Barnes, and we got him there in his wheelchair. And he was lifted onto the stage in his wheelchair, and then, of course, all the audience would shout and clap at anything. And all the bands saying there's nothing wrong with him because he's getting a standing ovation, because they're clapping him in a wheelchair. But he's managing to sing. And then there was the day when all the family, all the children and all the grandchildren came over to see him, and he didn't think he could get down the stairs. So they were making a film about George's end of life, the dementia and everything. So the cameraman and the sound man carried him down in his wheelchair, down the stairs and into the garden. It was the beginning of June, and it was lovely. And we all sat there, and he sat with Tom, our son, and was very particular about what he wanted done at his funeral. He made a list of what he was going to wear.
I'm going to have spats on my feet. And a bowler hat.
And suddenly, I realized he's dressing himself like Magritte.
And I'm going to be sitting in the front pews, watching.
No, George, you're not going to be sitting in the front pew. You're going to be in the coffin.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
But then there was, how do we get him back upstairs, back to his bed? He was clearly too weak to get back upstairs. So I decided then, right then and there, that this was the moment. Next door to the sitting room on the first floor was a little bedroom with a little kitchen. So I thought, I'll put him in that bed for the night. And I'll get the hospital bed ordered the next day. It was Sunday, so I had to wait till the next day. And the bed came the following day. And apart from getting up to do the last charity concert, he really didn't get out of bed again. I mean, he'd get up to use his commode. So that's not quite true that he didn't get out of bed. And once the dementia was bad, he'd struggled to get out of bed. He'd stopped eating. I'm beginning to feel incredibly tired. But I'm busy, not even making one egg omelets. anymore. Ice cream, that's all he could eat. Somehow, there's a lot to do because the hospital bed was fine. He liked being in the sitting room because he was surrounded by his collection of paintings, and he had two bedside tables, one on either side of the bed, and because of that, they had to be identical objects on each side of the bed so that if he woke up facing one way, well, he couldn't turn over easily and get what he needed, and so by the bed, there had to be a glass with 5 cigarettes in it, no more, no less. There had to be 5. There had to be 3 lighters on each side of the bed in case he dropped them. And there had to be his glasses. There had to be a glass of water on each side. An ashtray, certainly no 2. Oh, yes, there were 3 ashtrays. One so that if he put a cigarette out, he could put an ashtray over top of that. And then if he smoked another one, he could put another ashtray over top of that. Everything was becoming very, very demented. But it had to be total order, and he had to be keeping control of his 2 bedside tables, and they had to look just alike in some way. So if he woke up facing one way, it was the same as if he woke up facing the other. I quite enjoyed it, really. Now, I was sleeping in the little room next door with the 2 doors open, and I had a baby alarm so I could hear him when he turned over. But then he had 1 or 2 fainting fits. I'm getting help from the district nurses now, and I get a care package. They gave me 21 hours a week because George's job had, you know, really come to only 1 gig a month, which he was taken to. But otherwise, he was just in bed and not left alone either because of the fainting fits. A woman called Mary came, and she gave him a bath, a blanket bath. And then she'd come in the evening so I could go out and do some shopping or something, and then the district nurse would come, and every time they came, they wrote in a notebook what they'd done, what they used to leave that there next for the next nurse to see. And they would come about 2 or 3 times a week. And a palliative nurse came, and next to prognosis, they had written short, and that gave me a turn. By this time, the district nurse had brought me the package, all of the medication. She'd brought a thing called a syringe driver with her, and there were 3 lots of medications that we had. We could put them into it, and we had morphine. We had a thing if you had too much phlegm, but that made his mouth dry, so that was rather awkward. And there was a Valium-type thing in case he got agitated because, she explained to me, that sometimes just before somebody dies, they can get very agitated. Not necessarily, but they can. I don't think we used the morphine more than once or twice, and that was at the very, very end. But the first time we put the syringe driver in, we put it in his thigh, and he pulled it out immediately. So then we had to put it in behind his left shoulder and where he couldn't reach it. And we were still managing to talk quite a lot, not a deal, a great deal, but we did manage to tell a couple of jokes, which he liked, and he told me a joke. Such a quiet little voice, I could hardly hear it. And there were lots of people coming to see him. I had always thought there was 1 girlfriend that I would never allow in the house, but he really wanted to see her. So she came. And I remember my heart thumping on that day she was coming, thumping and thumping. And actually, it was fine. When somebody is dying, an awful lot goes out the window. And sometimes 2 or 3 people would come in a day, and some people were very, very good, and some just sort of quiet. It was just wonderful just to sort of sit there. Women, on the whole, make better visitors. Now he really isn't eating anything, and he isn't drinking. He's even stopped smoking.
When I first stopped smoking, I stopped for a week. And then I think I want a cigarette.
No, George, don't you remember? You've given up. You've got the nicotine patch.
Oh, yeah, no. Yes, I forgot.
I stopped being bad-tempered. And yes, I did like looking after him. Sometimes I slept on the sitting room floor on a rolled-up mattress because sometimes he would wake and he would struggle to get out of bed. And I remember once I was downstairs with some women friends and we were playing cards. And I said, I think I'll just pop upstairs and see if he's okay. And He had managed somehow to swing his legs over the rail on the bed, and I didn't know what he was, and he didn't know what he was doing or where he was, and all the women came up and they all tried to get him into bed, and we just couldn't. We just couldn't get him back in somehow, and he was really agitated at this time. So I rang the district nurse, and half an hour later, a district nurse came around, and she managed to get him back into bed, but on the whole, he was peaceful. So the last five nights, I had a Marie Curie nurse. I went to bed in the next room, and she sat there in with him. And they don't sleep. They just stay awake all night. Each night, I started to say goodbye. Every night, I said, this is goodbye. It's goodbye.
Goodbye.
And there he would be the next morning. And then a friend said to me, well, have you told him it's time for him to die? And I said, no, I didn't know you had to do that. So I said to George that night, you did your will. The children have been to see you. They've all been, and everything is okay. All your plans are as you want them, and you know, you can let go. And he looked pleased. Yes, he looked pleased about it. And then the next morning, there he was. It was different nurse every night, and they all wrote in the notebook. And sometimes they were a bit frightened of the two yappy dogs I had. There was a very nice one, Mary, an Irish woman. She liked the dogs. She was there the last night, and she wrote in the book, Diana and I changed the bed, and George looked up at her and smiled and whispered, good night. And then I went to bed. She wrote, at 2:20, I called Diana as instructed because his breathing was changing. And she came in and sat and held his hand. And then, after a while, he died. I kept that page. I tore it out. Yeah, I still have that bit of paper. Relief. Tearful relief, you know. At last. Thanks, George.
This is the last vignette. I also wanted to share with you that Diana in that play was a very good friend of Nell Dunn's, and this actually was her story. And they walked their dogs together every day, those two. So if you have any questions that you'd like to be asked at this point, please write them down. And we'll address those first, and then we'll go back to some of the general ones if we have time. I have a question this time for Zelda, our social worker. Zelda, when there is dementia, and George had a vascular dementia, but any kind of dementia, who is the decision maker?
Well, first and foremost, I have to state that dementia is a loss of memory, not a loss of intelligence. I read that somewhere and I thought it was brilliant, because we forget that people that have dementia are still very much able to speak for themselves, express their wishes, and participate in decision-making until they are no longer able to do so. So I think it's very important not to exclude them from any kind of dialogue that will take place with regards to planning for their future. I feel very strongly that's an important thing to say right off the top. We have a wonderful initiative here in Canada that's called Advanced Care Planning. If you want to go on their website, it's www.advancedcareplanning.ca. And they have wonderful documents on their website that are free for downloading. And it's really, their initiative is to help people start to speak about advanced care planning and start that dialogue and to start looking at what do they want? What are their wishes? And it's an initiative that everybody should partake in, not just those that have been diagnosed with a terminal illness. There's another wonderful initiative in Montreal as well. It's called The Living Will. It was pioneered at the Jewish General Hospital by Dr. Michael Dworkin. You can also look at that Living Will document on the Jewish General Hospital website. It's a little bit more specific with regards to what a person who is dying would want at the end of life, what kind of treatment and so on, and that should take place with a physician. When a person is no longer able to make decisions for themselves, we can call that inaptitude, incapacity, incompetency, depending on where you live in the world. There are several different ways of going about putting in a substitute decision maker. I would strongly recommend people do that before they become unable to make decisions for themselves. So in Quebec, we have what's called a mandate, and that is something that someone would put in place for the event that they become incapacitated. They name someone to make decisions for them. If you do not have that in place, you can go forward with a private curatorship, so it's a protective regime that would be put in place after the person becomes inept, or if need be, a public curatorship. But all to say that when someone's at the end of life, like George was, there is time if you were just diagnosed with dementia, a little less time when you have the dual diagnosis that he had. But certainly we saw from the example in the vignette that George was very capable of expressing himself and knowing what he wanted.
Thank you. We have some questions now from the audience.
Just to say that some of the documents that Zelda is talking about are available in the back here on this side, just in the end of the tables, if you wanted to see them. So a question I have, there seems to be a theme in the scenarios of telling people they can go or of telling them they should go. Is this a good idea? Golda.
I think that when there is open communication between the patient and the family members, where they can actually talk about the wishes of the patient and make sure that everything that the patient could possibly need to basically achieve before their end of life, that they're trying to meet these goals. I think that once those goals are met, I think we can basically come to the conclusion that they are now ready. And that if all the goals have not been met, that we'll try to somehow work around these things. If it's some kind of legacy work or whatnot. But certainly there needs to be that open communication to be able to talk about, now you can go. I don't think people need to be told that it's okay for them to die. It's not a necessity. Certainly people will die even regardless whether they're told that they can go or not. But it does seem for some patients that sometimes they seem to hang on when their bodies seem to be so close to the very end, and they seem to hang on for something to happen, maybe for some words to be said. So I think it can be very individual. If it looks like the patient, is just in the very last days and hours and still doesn't seem to die, and the family members feel that it's okay to give that permission, that might help facilitate things. Sometimes the patient needs to hear, to be reassured that basically things will be okay if they go. But it's very individual, and I don't think it's an absolute necessity.
In the plays, we heard that there were very many different types of nurses, the Macmillan nurses, the Marie Curie nurses. We know here in Montreal we have the oncology PIVO nurses, and we have the CLSC nurses, and we have the palliative care nurses from the specialty teams. We have the private nursing organizations such as Entrade, VilMarie, and Nova. So there are a lot of players in the life of someone as they journey towards death. So is it a good practice for the home care team to follow up with the dying patient's family after they die? And who would be best to do this? And do you have any comments on bereavement follow-up? Who should be doing it?
I'll take a stab at that. I think it depends on where the patient dies. I think if the patient is privileged to die at home, I think the home care team that's been following that patient is very much involved in the last stage of life and therefore probably would be in a position to follow up with that family. So I would think one is where the patient dies, but I also think it's the relationship that's been developed. And I think it's a conversation that needs to take place between the different teams that are helping this family and this patient, and they need to decide who could be best in a position. You know, you can have someone who's at home for 9 months and then enters hospital for 1 week. So it could be that the team that's been following them at home. I just think the bottom line is that someone has to follow up with this family.
I may add, very often the social worker from the CLSC has been involved for a long time, apart from just the nurses from the CLSC. So very often there is a follow-up done by the social worker from the CLSC to support the remaining family members.
Anita, as a family caregiver, do you have any comments?
One thing I could also add is that perhaps families, in my case, there were important people in my life in the community that helped me, not necessarily nurses or social workers, but family support people or dear friends.
I have a question here. How can we greatly increase the availability of palliative care clergy for our home care patients? Do any of you have any experience reaching out into the community for spiritual support? And if so, could you share your thoughts?
I always ask that question. Do they need that kind of support? Sometimes people have become estranged from their spiritual practice, but I've been very lucky in being able to reach people that I know that have done palliative care and are still willing to make home visits. So I think it's a very important component to encourage, but I always ask the question to make sure that is being taken care of.
In my experience, we've always been able to have some support from clergy or any pastoral services as well, from other religious denominations in the community. Usually they will come to the home as long as the person has been associated with that religion. We have had times where we've had to call the Diocese of Montreal, for instance, and ask if there was anyone that could come to the home because that person had not been in touch with their religion for a number of years and did not have a connection. And we've always had a very positive response. So I think the willingness is out there. It's a matter of communicating with them.
Thank you. Joan, we have time for a few more questions, so I'll let Joan...
A question that came in also is we often hear of cancer patients being taken care of at home from palliative care teams, but are those same teams prepared to take care of other diseases, ALS, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis. These neurological diseases often require different comfort measures. And if those teams are not well prepared, how do they cooperate with the neurological teams? Anita will address that to you.
Thank you. In the situation with my husband, he had Parkinson's, and quite ill the last 3 years, and it was a very skilled palliative care community nurse who responded to me when I asked her to get me a suction machine. And she said, "You need more than a suction machine, Anita." And she said, "You need palliative care." And about 48 hours later, a palliative care physician and a palliative care nurse came to visit, and that began a very, very comforting relationship for both of us. So the interdisciplinary team in palliative care can certainly come to help people with other neurological illnesses.
Thank you, Anita. Okay, that was our last question for this evening. However, our panel will be here till 9 o'clock, so if you have any questions that you'd like to bring to them, we certainly welcome you to do that. And I'd like to ask Greta Chambers to come forward to offer the closing remarks.
Sorry, the questions have terminated. I found them very, very interesting and so matched to what we have just seen. I say thank you all for coming, and merci d'être nous pour partager avec nous cette présentation, which I found that it was those readers of those vignettes really brought death at home to life. And it also showed death in such a, it made it so natural and so, in a way, livable and so sad but so human that it was, you know, it completely removed all the horrors that one feels when one thinks about death. And that is such an important thing to have, because when we have many people here, and all the panelists, wonderful panelists. Now, I should mention that those actors, I'll do the actors first, because they were really, I thought, wasn't George wonderful? Anyway, I found them very, very telling, and I think that they really brought up all those questions that came afterwards, that was, should this be done and that be done? Because some of them I found quite extraordinary. But the idea that you don't say, "I love you" enough when you're trying very hard to look brave, that is such a very natural thing, and it was very well portrayed here, I think. I must say, I think all of us, very grateful for the panelists. Now, you know, I found that they had their deep, deep insights and their experience, their expertise, professional expertise, and their so compassionate perspective, I think was really both enlightening. They were both enlightening and very, very comforting. So I found this a very revealing couple of hours, and I think that the questions were carried right on and made it even more rewarding evening than it would have been if we just had the experts. So we all are leaving with a great deal to think about, and I think that this has been a very, very valuable exercise. So good evening and bonne fin de journée.
Thank you all for coming out. As I say, if you have any questions for the panel, they are here. There's also papers and booklets some of you may have not picked up on the table. Please do so, as well as the newsletter from the Council on Palliative Care at the back. Please take copies for yourself or your friends, and thank you so much for coming out.